Complexes, complices, you're the man with the imperial degree, you tell me.
Do you need one to pronounce that word? I don't know, but okay.
ISMN, that's isazorbide mononitrate for
the surgical group
for the surgical population. And I had to memorize it this morning. The English is very hard. did you take your statins this morning?
And my blood pressure medication.
Blood pressure medication. Excellent, excellent. Today we're talking about atrial fibrillation.
Absolutely, comes up all the time. Critical care. As surgeons, we don't always like talking about the critical care stuff, but it's very important because remember, every single station has the same number of points in your exam. It's not a case of just being excellent in your own subspecialty. It could be, you know, good across the board. So atrial fibrillation, let's do it.
What's the definition of atrial fibrillation?
Atrial fibrillation is, in very simple terms, is an unregulated or discoordinated activity of the atrium. And that usually results in irregular pulse.
What are the causes, would you say, of atrial fibrillation?
Good question. And that's what they will ask you. Maybe not so directly. They may give you a scenario, but they may actually ask at some point, even if they do give you a scenario, they may ask you exactly what the causes are.
The scenario is coming.
And the scenario is coming. Great. Can't wait. There's always more. And the important thing is, like everything we talked about when you've been asked to give a differential diagnosis or treatments, is to have things in boxes. So you'd start off by saying the causes of atrial fibrillation are quite wide, but broadly they can be categorized as cardiac causes, so things directly to do with the heart, systemic pathology, medical therapy or medication related, and that's your main kind of three boxes. So then you go back to each one and say cardiac causes is quite straightforward. It's usually existing ischemic heart disease or a myocardial infarction. Systemic causes, again, you need to have subcategories. They can be due to sepsis and infection, which is usually the kind of scenario they like giving you, i.e. from an anastomotic leak. Not that we ever have one.
No, never had the problem.
There's a case report where someone reverts back into sinus following a PR exam because of the increased vagal tone.
It's an RCT waiting to happen.
Always good to have non-surgical input into these things, and our colleague there, being a trainee GP, has very helpfully reported that N equals one case report that you'll never see again. The systemic pathologies are infections, clots such as pulmonary embolism, electrolyte imbalance, metabolic pain, hypothermia and hypovolemia and hypotension. So they're the main systemic ones. Then there's drug therapy. And that could be because the patient hasn't had the usual drugs that they're on to control their existing AF, or it could be other drugs that actually cause AF. Drug withdrawal as well, mainly benzodiazepine, alcohol, and cocaine, which, you know, is never used in the population in the area that I work in.
Never.
They're the kind of broad categories that you want to put them into.
It's day five post-subjectomy. Your patient has miraculously survived your operation 5 days now, and it's the ward round in the morning, and their heart rate is 130.
Yeah.
Their systolic is 100. Their saturation is 94% on 4 liters of oxygen. And their background includes type 2 diabetes, as well as ischemic heart disease, for which they take ISMN. Isazorbide mononitrate for the surgical population. And I had to memorize it this morning.
Yeah.
And their chest drain is swinging. It's day five, you're still keeping the chest drain in, but okay. It's serous, hemiserous fluid. They're talking, they're talking, they're set up. They're a bit slightly short of breath.
And that scenario painted could be, they can give you a colorectal patient, they can give you just about any patient. It doesn't really matter, it's the same thing. And you start off by saying this is clearly a very serious situation where the patient is in physiological extremis. And my concerns would be, and then you'd say what? So the concerns here are going to be mainly you're going to be worried about anastomotic leak, or infection, sepsis, one of the main causes in the surgical scenarios with regards to AF. It could also be cardiac as well because of the pre-existing cardiac situation you told us about. It could also be electrolyte imbalances and fluid resuscitation, pulmonary embolism, of course, and somebody who's got cancer and has had a major resection.
And a thoracotomy.
And a thoracotomy. Minimally invasive, surely.
Still a thoracotomy.
Yes. Yeah, open-assisted.
Leg-assisted.
With any patient who is critically unwell, I would assess the patient as per the CRISP protocol, ensuring assessment and simultaneous resuscitation and treatment. And at that point, they usually, you'd mentioned that you would and you don't want to get bogged down into the A, B, C, D cannula. You'd say, having ensured that I've familiarized myself with the patient's notes, if you're not the operating surgeon, because they may say a colleague operated on your patient and it's Saturday afternoon or something, and having familiarized myself with the patient history and how they've been doing in the last and their progress in a post-operative period by reviewing all the charts, ensuring that relevant investigations, including blood tests, ECG, maybe chest X-ray, blood gas, remember your sepsis 6, have been obtained, and adequate risk fluid resuscitation antibiotics given, I would look for the underlying cause as to the patient's condition. And they usually say, oh, you mentioned ECG, that you see this. What would you see on ECG if it is an AF situation?
Absolutely, look at everything, succinct fashion, look at the op notes, look at the past medical history, anesthetic sheet.
Anesthetic sheet.
Yeah.
It's a new type of sheath we're bringing in.
Absolutely. Anesthetic sheet, look at the background of the patient.
Sponsored by the Teletubbies, yeah, right?
Look at all of that. As part of the ECG, this is AF station that we're looking at. So the ECG findings are you don't find any P waves, you're finding irregular QRS complexes. Complexes, complices, you're the man with the imperial degree, you tell me.
Do you need one to pronounce that word? I don't know, but okay.
The English is very hard. You're looking at this in the context of the systolic as well to tell if it's fast AF or not. What is the definition of fast AF?
Fast AF is a tachycardia, which technically speaking would be above 90 now rather than 100, but certainly they're not going to give you something that's borderline. 90 is meant to be what we're counting tachycardia now, but don't get into the weeds of it as they say, because they're not going to give you something very borderline. They're going to give you somebody who's got a heart rate 125, something like that. And they're also going to say, as part of your assessment, of course, the blood pressure, they're going to say, oh, well, actually, the blood pressure's low. And that's the key bit, isn't it? It's the physiological impact that this dysrhythmia has, rather than just, you know, somebody can be completely well with a heart rate of 95 that's in AF. But somebody... So it's really the impact it has on the blood pressure and the circulation, and it will give you that.
So you've done the ECG. There's no PR. There's no P waves. Your QR complexes are all over the place. There's no inverted or raised T waves. So there's no suspicion of MI.
I know what that means? Yeah.
I don't know what that means. That's the only thing we know what that means.
Just make sure the ECG. You're not old.
The writing's on the top. Yeah.
But the ECG is the squiggly stuff on a pink paper, just in case.
Just give it to your F1. They'll interpret it for you. And you've gone through the whole of the checklist. You've got CT scans. There are no major leaks. You've done an OGD. The conduit is not dead. This is just AF from the insult of injury, as you insult of surgery, as you have identified. What would you do now?
Okay, so the statement that you want to make here is, my overriding strategy would be to control, and here is the rate. So whenever you get a scenario like this, irrespective of AF or anything else, it'd be good to just let the examiner know what you're thinking. And that's the higher level thinking they keep talking about. So it's not just about just delving in, but having an appreciation of what your overall management direction you want to go towards, and making it known that you are flexible to change that as the situation evolves. So in this scenario, my overall strategy is to establish a good circulation pattern, to establish rate rather than rhythm. So you're not trying to bring them back into sinus rhythm. You're trying to, I mean, that'd be great, but what your main priority is making sure they're not getting 125, 140, 150 and into ischemia, and especially an elderly patient. With this in mind, I'm going to initiate a set of treatments as per the NICE protocol, in line with the CRISP, alongside the CRISP protocol treatments we've already initiated. So that's oxygen, fluid resuscitation, antibiotics if need be. And then you want to specifically say how you're going to treat the rate. How are you going to treat
Shout out to Mr. Ed Chong for teaching me this. So it's A, B, C, D. A is amiodarone. I think it's 300 milligrams as a loading dose, stat. And you're going about this with support from your medical and colleagues.
As always, you're going to say, this is going to be highlighted to colleagues and treated in an MDT kind of fashion. You want the intensivist or the anesthetist and a medical consultant or registrar involved.
And someone that won't have a man protocols. But you're loading those 300 milligrams of amiodarone. Yeah. And you might also choose to load them up with misoprolol.
Yeah, so that's your A and B. So beta blocker, so amiodarone, a short acting or a quick acting beta blocker.
Misoprolol, I think five milligrams was the first shot. And then you monitor how that goes. You might choose to repeat the misoprolol or then move on to calcium channel blockers.
Yep. Some places do give more shorter acting ones and with time involved.
Misoprolol or labetalol.
Do what your trust says, but ultimately, as soon as you say, as long as you say beta blocker of sorts, is usually the right answer.
Calcium channel blocker, and then assess what that does. And then lastly, again, with advice from your medical colleagues, you might start a digoxin regimen with loading dose, maintenance, and then reducing it.
That's your ABCD, and it's always good to keep things nice and simple for us surgeons. So your A is your hemolography, B is your beta blocker, C is a calcium.
Not simple enough. I'm sorry. We'll write it in crayon next time.
Amlodipine, that's the thing with a mixture of systolic, a bit lower or higher, I don't know, but yeah, sorry. It's amiodarone, thank you. And a beta blocker, a calcium channel blocker, and digoxin. Okay. And you also want to say, because especially if the patient's in hypotensive and in physiological difficulty, monitored bed. Monitored bay, card CCU, ICU, HDU, time observation, so you can see your response to treatment. And once you've given your ABCD, you also want to make sure that if there is an underlying cause, which they may give you a scenario like a chest infection or a leak or something, you also want to make, or they're very dehydrated, they haven't had enough fluids, you want to make sure that you are correcting that as well. So you're not just focusing on giving people a whole bunch of drugs without actually treating the underlying cause.
Absolutely. And lastly, if the drugs fail, what's the last? What else?
The last thing would be to undergo DC cardioversion, so electrical cardioversion. That's usually done in the anaesthetic room in the theatre under sedation with a medical registrar or consultant present, and obviously anaesthetist as well. Somewhere where they can be safely monitored and they cardioversion. If that really fails, or if that is partially successful or immediately successful, they may even require a pacemaker, and that may be a temporary pacemaker, but that is not something that you're going to go into great detail with. Yeah, but just an awareness. So they're the stage. So it's the drugs, cardioversion, and possibly a pacemaker of sorts, temporary otherwise.
If they are rate controlled and but they're getting better, they're about to be discharged, but they are still in AF, then you would start to have a conversation with the hematologist about keeping them anticoagulated.
Yep.
On the long term.
There's two kind of scoring systems you need to know. One is the risk of stroke and the risk of kind of thromboembolic incident, and that's the CHAD-VASc2. And that is a composite score that you get. There's an online calculator, and all the categories you don't really need to know. I mean, I think you did for part one, so hopefully you may remember some of it. But for part B, for the actual viva, you don't really need to know the subgroups, but just know there's a CHAD-VASc2 score. And then there's also the risk of, okay, you're going to anticoagulate to reduce the risk of stroke or thromboembolic events. What's the risk of your management causing bleeding? And that used to be the HAS-BLED, but it's now the ORBIT. And that's the new nice guideline. They're the two scores you need to know. And that's ultimately, of course, you're going to alert the GP through your discharge summary, which I'm sure will be comprehensive and not at all have massive gaps in it. You're going to want to make sure this patient is followed up. If there is an underlying cardiological problem or they've got existing cardiological issues, you want your cardiology colleagues to follow them up and see them and write to them as well. And again, you may think, well, this is kind of, is this really exam things? But this is one of the things that people don't score very highly on, is the higher level thinking, and that's what they want you to say. So even though it's not something you're going to do yourself, it's just having that awareness and not your just
support network as a clinician, basically.
You remember for your MRCS, it was all about patients really unwell, I need to fix it kind of thing, just do the immediate thing. But for your FRCS, it's really about the wider long-term health and picture of that you want to be involved in. And statements like this, like communicating with GP colleagues and colleagues in kind of secondary care or even referral to a tertiary center for whatever reason, is what's going to tick your, oh, this person's got a holistic, overall, higher level thinking box.
Great.
And that's it. You'll be pleased to know that it's going to be a quick station. It'll be a 5-minute station, probably even less, because they may throw two things at you.
You're limited by the knowledge that everyone in the room has. But
which is usually going to be less than what you already know, but don't get bogged down into the specific details, but just have the higher order level thinking and make sure you're progressing and make sure you're involving your colleagues. That's it.
Nice.